This morning, in this hour of the show, we will take a little trip to, in a metaphorical sense, to Fayetteville, North Carolina, a town that in many ways has been shaped by war. Not because war has been fought on its soil, but because this country has fought wars other places. Fayetteville is the home of, or neighbor of, a very large military installation, Fort Bragg. And we'll be talking this morning with Catherine Lutz. She is an anthropologist. She's professor of anthropology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and has authored a book that looks at the ways that the presence of the base has shaped the town of Fayetteville. Her book is titled Homefront, A Military City in the American 20th Century, published by the Beacon Press. And we'll be talking this morning about the book. And as we do, of course, questions, comments are welcome. Anyone listening can call in. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good. Anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Lutz, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thanks for talking with us.
Sure.
So what was the story that you were trying to tell here with the Homefront?
I was trying to tell the story of how Fayetteville has been shaped by the military, but it's really treating Fayetteville as a kind of microcosm of the rest of the country. There are really literally hundreds of places like it that have military bases, but in another sense, it really mirrors the rest of the nation in lots of respects. So by looking at Fayetteville, I hope to see in sharper relief things that are happening everywhere across the country.
And as an anthropologist, did that dictate a particular kind of approach that would have been different from that taken by somebody who came from some other discipline?
Well, yes. I use the methods of anthropology, but also the methods of history. But what I did as an anthropologist was basically to go to Fayetteville and just try and meet as many kinds of people as I could. I went to a wide variety of places, walked through the mall, went to city government meetings. Basically, the method of anthropology is being just slightly inappropriately friendly and just walking up to people and starting to chat. And then people sometimes gave me long interviews, and those were really just fascinating. And a lot of the book is in the words of the people of Fayetteville.
Is Fort Bragg big as military installations go?
Yes, it's one of the largest in the country.
And North Carolina also has I don't know how it compares with other states, but it seems to have a lot of, not only does he have this one that's one of the biggest in the country, but it also has a lot of other bases also in the state of North Carolina, too.
Right. It has Camp Lejeune, which is also another large base, but there are nearly 1,000 domestic military bases, small and large. So North Carolina's got a good number, but most states can claim quite a few.
The base, and I guess it was before it was Fort Bragg, it was called Camp Bragg.
Right.
And I think that this was 1918 when it was established.
It was World War I that brought it to the city.
How is it that it ended up being there in North Carolina? Was it something that people locally there were interested in, or was it a case that the government decided, well, we need to have this base, and that seemed like a good place?
Well, it was a combination of those two things. Fayetteville had been the second largest city in the state at one point early in the 19th century, but it had fallen on hard times, and so the city's boosters went out really actively campaigning for this base. And at the same time, the U.S. government was looking for a very large tract of land to test its new artillery guns, which shot very long distances, and so they were in need of land, and they picked areas around the country that were relatively sparsely populated, but still displaced quite a few people.
Hmm. That I guess that is one of the issues that you deal with. Who ends up being displaced? There were people living on the land that came to be Camp Bragg and then Fort Bragg.
Right. There were hundreds of families and churches and a real community, and so those people suffered a real hardship. What's interesting is to see that when they went looking for places with relatively sparse populations and little infrastructure, that tended to correlate, unfortunately, with areas of the state that were poorer and had more African Americans. Those were the areas that had been relatively neglected when various kinds of public monies were being allocated. So it was that was also what led Camp Lejeune to be in an area that was heavily African American.
Well, did those people, was there some compensation, or did someone just come along and say, well, you just have to move now?
Well, they didn't have any choice, but they were compensated for the land, but not for the loss of their community and their churches and the network of friends and family that they had in the area.
How did the coming of the camp, how many people came there that weren't there before? In what way did it affect the population of the area?
Well, initially there were not huge numbers of people who came. World War I was over before they completed building Camp Bragg, so the base basically stayed quite small until World War II. There were only 3,000 soldiers there through that whole interwar period. So the city of Fayetteville remained a kind of vibrant, it had its own economy. It had textile mills and manufacturing, and it retained that as its main economic base until World War II, when suddenly hundreds of thousands of soldiers came through, and the town was changed forever at that point.
Yeah. It's interesting to see that if you look at the mindset, the way that people thought about the military, thought about the need for the military, thought about military preparedness, if you compare the mindset after Pearl Harbor with the mindset before, that in fact there was a big change, and that beforehand, before the U.S. got involved in World War II, there was not necessarily great enthusiasm for the military. How did people there in Fayetteville think about the base, say before Pearl Harbor?
Well, what's interesting is that when the boosters went out looking for the base, went out recruiting it, they failed the first couple of times they tried. At one point in the newspaper, I found a quote which basically said, well, it's a good thing we didn't get this base. If we had, there would be soldiers prowling through the streets looking to make mayhem and looking to chase our daughters and our wives, and it's just as well we don't have this. And then, of course, there were many people whose point of view wasn't really much articulated in the newspaper, who may have also not been very happy about that. But there were some people who were going to benefit from it and who eventually did, get to make some money from selling real estate and selling things to soldiers.
I guess that there you come to what is one of the big questions, and I suppose that anywhere that you're looking at a town that's near a large military installation, you have to ask, what are the trade-offs? You would expect, and indeed the presence of the base would mean that there would be soldiers there that would have money in their pockets, and they would be spending it in the community. On the other hand, there are some downsides, and that is that there may be trouble related to their being there. There may be the kind of businesses that would cater to them that the local Chamber of Commerce wouldn't be real high on. And then there's also the issue of costs, other sorts of costs that the presence of the soldiers create that the community simply has to bear, that are not reimbursed by the government. Now, if you look at those things on balance, is the economic impact positive, or is it in fact negative?
Well, the way I answer that question is by saying basically it depends on who you're talking about. There are some people who benefit and others who bear most of the costs. And here's how that works out. People who own businesses can take some profits from them, but small businesses are very vulnerable to what I call the war cycle, which is a kind of twin to the business cycle. So that when troops deploy, there's a sudden implosion of economic activity, and small restaurant owners, small business owners can suffer or go under. The people who also suffer there are retail workers, who are the lowest category of lowest paid category of worker that the census notes. And so those people are already, on the best of circumstances, are working poor. But when the soldiers deploy, it becomes that they often have no savings and they really go under. So unfortunately, those people don't get any kind of help usually. So the costs are the kind of job that the job that that kind of base creates are low-paying jobs. And then again, the tax base is quite low. There's a huge amount of land which is now federal property, pays no taxes, and that also leads to pretty poor public services compared to neighboring communities that have better tax bases.
Our guest here this morning, I should introduce again, is Catherine Lutz. She's professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and is the author of this book that we're talking about. The title is Homefront, A Military City and the American 20th Century. It's published by the Beacon Press, and it is about Fayetteville, North Carolina, that is neighbor to Fort Bragg, one of the country's biggest military installations. And she looks at what the presence of the base has meant for the town going back to 1918, when it was first set up, and coming up to the present. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit about how before World War II thought about the base and might have had mixed feelings about the presence of all these soldiers. Once the United States entered the war, did people think differently? Did their attitude about the presence of the soldiers change because now there was growing public sentiment for the American involvement in the war, and there was some sense in which everybody was in this thing together?
Right. Yes, definitely. There are people who tell stories about the incredible stresses that the war placed on the city, but how people responded with incredible resolve and hard work. People did a lot more work each day. I'm talking about the civilians, and some of them took soldiers into their homes because there wasn't enough housing for them or for their families on base. So they took in strangers. They did kind of double or triple duty days, doing many women who hadn't worked before went to work on base or in the community. And so it was really it was difficult for them, but people remembered it as a time of a lot of work, but a lot of common spirit.
How did they feel about fraternization, the involvement of local girls and young women with soldiers?
Yeah, well, there was a lot of fear about that, and that was the sentiment that I mentioned just earlier about when I was talking about the World War One period, and there was certainly a lot of concern that, as one woman told me, she said, we were very friendly to the soldiers, but our parents didn't want us to be too friendly. Mm-hmm. So they were being warned particularly about the enlisted soldiers, and so there was a bit of a class bias in some of this, that they were, it would be okay if they met and socialized with the officer class, but the enlisted class was another matter.
Yeah, apparently there were opportunities. Say there were dances where young women could go, and I'm sure that they were chaperoned and all, but they could go and mingle with the officers, and that was pretty much okay. But depending upon what the social class and social standing of that young woman and her family was,
right,
they might have not been too keen about the idea of dating an enlisted man. I'm not sure why an officer is necessarily better. Maybe have to do with that officer and gentleman by act of Congress thing.
All right, and also that there were more likely to have been college educated.
Oh. Uh-huh. Race certainly is a theme that runs through here. And at the time, the U.S. military was still segregated. The white troops and the African-American troops lived separately. Mm-hmm. And, of course, segregation would have been a fact of life in Fayetteville at the time. Did the presence of the base somehow intensify the issue of race or friction around race? Did it make it somehow more important than it might have been if the base wasn't there?
Well, yes, I think in certain ways it did, and this is true both of race and of class, because what these all of these new people did was disrupt the status quo of social relationships that people had and social hierarchies that were accepted of class and race. And so what I found in looking in the archives was that in city council meetings, people began to talk about the need for more careful and more detailed laws regulating who could eat with whom and what, having separate entrances to restaurants for whites and blacks. So that was clearly a response to the threat that these new people, including particularly soldiers from the North, who hadn't experienced quite the same degree of racial discrimination or racial segregation. Obviously, it was still a problem in the North, but the city had to felt itself challenged and tried to clamp down on race mixing.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that there would also have been black soldiers who would have been there also that ordinarily would not. Would that have meant that the African-American population of the area would have been more than it would have been otherwise?
Would have been more?
There would have been more black men there, say, because the base was there, than there would have been if the base, you know, had not been there.
Oh, yes, that definitely. The base brought black soldiers. And soldiering is gives people a citizenship status that they don't normally have. And so that was part of the threat, that a black man in uniform was making a claim on citizenship that he was seen by some whites as not deserving. So there were racial problems across the country throughout World War II. So black soldiers who were lynched in uniform. I found the account of a soldier who was killed downtown Fayetteville by a white military policeman. And I think those kinds of stories have tended not to be told in some of these more recent celebratory histories of World War II. It just doesn't quite fit with the idea of the good war as one that had was just a war against fascism and a war against Nazism. But in fact, the fight against fascism had to be fought at home as well. And this young man, this private at Fort Bragg, paid for that with his own life.
Hmm.
That was a remarkable story that's in the book.
Well, was that something that got coverage at the time in the more mainstream media that existed? Was it something that people point out the irony that here it is, we're battling fascism and we're fighting this great evil and we're fighting for the freedom of the world, and yet here at home the reality doesn't seem to score up with what it is that we say that we're all about.
Right, yeah. It was covered very, very briefly in the local paper. There was a big headline that said, shootout on bus in downtown Fayetteville, and then it disappeared from the newspaper. But the African-American press, which at the time was a very vigorous and large force in American society, there were millions of readers, daily readers of the black press, they took up the cause. And between their work and the NAACP, there was a petition to the War Department for an official investigation, and that did occur. Unfortunately, it sort of whitewashed the matter, but it resulted in a large archive of material that I was able to look at in the National Archives, and also very fascinating material there.
We're almost at the midpoint here of this part of Focus, and I'd like to again introduce our guest. Catherine Lutz is professor of anthropology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And the book that she's written that's all about Fayetteville and how it has been shaped by the presence of Fort Bragg, the book is titled Homefront, A Military City and the American 20th Century. It's published by the Beacon Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the things that's interesting, I think, is the way in which the presence of the base has made Fayetteville probably a more cosmopolitan kind of place than it would have been otherwise, in part because servicemen went abroad. They went to Europe. They went to Asia. And some of them married women from there, and then their wives came back, and they settled in the United States. So here now, the Fayetteville would have this community of people who were new to America that, again, otherwise they probably wouldn't have had. How did that contribute, or did that indeed end up changing the way people thought about the other there?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to finish answering the question you'd asked earlier about what some of the costs and benefits are of having the basin, and that this is certainly one of the benefits. This is the most cosmopolitan, diverse, and interesting city in North Carolina, and I'd include Chapel Hill or Raleigh or Charlotte. It's really very, very interesting place, with people having many different kinds of experiences, and not just soldiers, but, again, these families of soldiers who've come from elsewhere, and people from town who've traveled for other reasons. It's not nearly as provincial as people might imagine a quiet southern town being. There's also the fact that the town has a much larger middle class than it would otherwise have because the military's there. In general, military spending across the country tends to widen the gap between the rich and the poor. And the way that happens is kind of complicated. But basically, military spending creates a smaller number of jobs than does social spending. And a lot of the military budget goes into the profits of the military industries. So a few people profit, the shareholders of those companies, the high paid labor, the engineering and technical labor that works for, let's say, Raytheon. Those people can become even wealthier through the military budget. On the other hand, in some of these military personnel cities like Fayetteville, you find people working at minimum wage, and really, again, the gap between the rich and the poor gets wider through that distribution of the military budget. But the soldiers themselves the bulk of soldiers earn a reasonable kind of middle class wage. The gap between the highest and the lowest paid worker in the military is 1 to 8. I mean, in the civilian world, that's can be 1 to 1,000. So, in some ways, the military is the most socialized sector of American society. Soldiers themselves occasionally refer to it as, a small sort of socialist society, really good benefits and so on. So, in that way, having soldiers in the mix of Fayetteville's economy creates a strong middle class, and that's always good for democracy because you don't have these inequalities exacerbating and polarizing the community.
Mm-hmm. And I would expect that too, if you ask how are things different today from say at the period of World War II, I would guess that two major differences, and these certainly would have impacts on the community, would be that there are more military personnel who live off of the base, and that there are probably also more military personnel who have families. And I would expect that those two things would have a, in many different ways, a fairly profound impact on the community.
Yeah, the big change occurred in 1973 with the all-volunteer force, and then suddenly people were able to many people began to marry and bring their families with them to town. Although those people continue often to retain residence in another state where there might not be a state income tax, and so they don't vote in local elections often until they retire. And that has tended to make for the lowest, for pretty weak local democracy, on the other hand, because those people don't Fayetteville does have the lowest voting registration rate of any city in the state. Mm. But again, those people are looking for better schools. Unfortunately, the tax base still doesn't allow them to find that. So, what people also point out is that soldiers used to make their social life on base. They now make it back at home. If they're family men or family women, they stay at home. And so there's a little more restaurants in town as people, socialize off base or live off base. But, yes, it's kind of mixed story.
Yeah, that here you would have people that they would be spending money. They'll be going out to eat. They'll be buying furniture and clothing and going to the movies and things like that. So they will be putting money into the local economy, and yet their contribution to the tax base is probably less than it would be other places.
Right. And they're often younger families, and those families tend to have are associated in any place with higher public costs. They draw more in terms of the use of the courts, the roads, the schools, and of the public facilities.
It must have been a palpable letdown for the community after the war. I'm sure on the one hand, everybody was very happy the war was over. But at the same time, there was a real contraction in the military, and people there at Fayetteville certainly must have felt it.
At the end of World War II?
At the end of World War II. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And in general, every one of these sort of expansions and contractions has had a pretty traumatic effect on the economy of the city. Businesses just closed down, and people have had to adjust. So it's not like any other economy.
How did when World War II ended and then we got into the Cold War, and people started thinking about the fact that, yes, maybe there still would be war, that we still did have an enemy, but that things were different, and people's concerns about nuclear weapons and nuclear war started to get hold of people and shape the way that people thought. It certainly shaped the way Americans thought and affected what they were worried about, and that came out in the popular culture in a lot of interesting ways. How did that manifest itself there in Fayetteville? And did people really start thinking differently once we got into the Cold War and people were worried about the possibility of nuclear war?
Well, what struck me is that very few people who I spoke with seemed to have been especially concerned about that, concerned about the problem of living close to a military base that could become a target of nuclear weapons. I think most people were fairly realistic across the country, and they knew if there were a full-scale nuclear war that it didn't quite matter where you were, that the gig was going to be up. But what was interesting was that what I found was that people in Fayetteville lived much more intimately with the idea of nuclear war in the form of war games that were played on the base and that sometimes spilled over the boundary of the base. And so they saw the military much more up close, engaged in both nuclear war games. There was an amazing war game called Operation Flashburn that occurred in the early 50s, in which the Army was trying to demonstrate its capability of fighting a nuclear war. It had been under quite some stress at that point. General Eisenhower, then President Eisenhower, despite being an Army man, had cut the Army in half and had basically counted on the Air Force to be the new the service that was going to be at the center of his strategy of nuclear warfare. So they were playing war games that were meant both to practice these new techniques of war, but also to convince other services and the president that they were that they shouldn't suffer further cuts and that they had a vital role in nuclear warfare. So that was interesting to read about.
You mentioned the fact that people who were living near the base didn't necessarily feel more threatened because the base was there than other people, because everybody felt threatened.
Right.
I wonder, did it necessarily might it in some cases have made them feel safer or somehow more confident? That is, because they did have contact with the military and they saw them there, and that it might give them the feeling that, well, no matter what happened, here we have this military and they're ready and they're capable and they're good people and they will do what they need to do.
I didn't hear people speak that way either. I think it just became a kind of normal background noise to most people's lives through this period. Just a kind of a sense of risk that being next to a military base wasn't going to make you feel any safer.
When Vietnam happened, was their protest against the war and against the presence of the military there.
Well, this is what most surprised me of all the research that I did through the whole century, was to see that era and to see what happened in Fayetteville. Most people would assume that an army town would have been a place where you would see very little dissent. You would have seen a lot of hostility towards the idea of dissent. But in fact, there was a tremendous amount of dissension within the military, and I found there were nearly 2,000 court-martials at Fort Bragg of soldiers in 1968 alone. So that's remarkable. Lots of AWOL soldiers. The Department of Defense did a survey that showed that nearly half of all low-ranking soldiers had been what they called dissident or disobedient, disobeying orders. And when you add drug use to that in the survey, it was over 55%. And they found that the majority of the people who were dissenting against the war were not draftees, and they weren't new soldiers. They were volunteers, people who'd volunteered to serve, and they were people who were returnees from the war, people who had been there, seen it, and came back and told stories and of what they had seen. And there were civilian dissenters as well who came from, often from some of the local universities, including UNC and Duke. But the soldiers were really at the core of the anti-war movement in Fayetteville.
Hmm. We have about 15 minutes left. I just want to remind people who are listening, if you do have questions, comments, want to be involved in the conversation, you can do that easily by calling us. Don't wait till the very end. Our guest this morning is Catherine Lutz. She is an anthropologist. She teaches at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she has written the book Homefront, A Military City and the American 20th Century. It's about Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is neighbor to a very large military installation, Fort Bragg. And the book looks at what the presence of the fort, which has been there since 1918, what that's meant for the town of Fayetteville, North Carolina, and not just what it means with this specific relationship between this base and this town is, but how that story has probably been played out over and over again a lot of other places around the country as well. The book is published by the Beacon Press. And again, the number here locally, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As you say, it seems that with a town like this next to a very large military installation, there's going to be cycles of sort of up and down when you look at impact on the community, particularly economic impact, depending on what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of up and down, up and down, up and down. In the era, say, since the end of the Vietnam War, and really since the end of the Cold War, There has now been contraction in defense. A number of bases around the country have actually closed. In fact, we had one here in our neighborhood. We had an Air Force base that's close by here that was closed a number of years back, and that community has faced a real challenge dealing with the closing of the base and what that's meant for their economy. So Fort Bragg hasn't closed, but how have things changed there for the town, say, in the post-Cold War period?
Well, Fort Bragg really benefited from the end of the Cold War in terms of the amount of money that went into it. Even though the military budget dropped by 18% initially, overall, it grew back, and it was nearly to the average of the Cold War level by the end of this decade, by 2000, 2001. So, even though there were a lot of base closings and individual communities suffered some dislocations, the military budget as a whole did not stay permanently contracted. And Fort Bragg in particular was got a lot of additional funds because it has the airborne and special operations, which are considered the units which are the face of modern warfare, or postmodern warfare, some people would say.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, they're involved now in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I think here I mentioned the fact that we had an Air Force base in Rantoul, Chanute Air Force Base, that had been there, I believe that had been there since World War, around the time of World War I. So it had been there, a presence for a long, long time, and I'm sure that the folks there thought it would be there forever, I guess, and until that day came when they got that bad news that the base was going to close. I suppose, do people there in Fayetteville, do they even consider the possibility that Fort Bragg might close, or do they believe, and maybe with justification, that it's always going to be there?
Yeah, I think there's very little fear that the base would close. It's probably down at the very, very bottom of the list of any potential base closing. But I think, you know, some communities that did have the base closings rebounded quite well and found that, again, some of these costs of being a military-based community, they no longer suffered the costs. They lost some of the advantages, but the costs had already been so normalized and accepted that when they ended, people said, "Oh, look! Now we've got in general higher-paying work that we've been able to bring in. We've got tax-paying property where we didn't before." And so, some communities have found it to their benefit.
I think that the folks in Rantoul here, our neighbors, have done very well. I know that it's been very difficult, and they've gone through some tough times. But it has necessitated some creative thinking. And I'm not sure that the government was always all that helpful. They still have some problems on their hands, including there's a building there that I think was once, I think before the Pentagon was built, it was the biggest office building in the world that's still there, and that has a lot of problems with environmental impact. And, you know, they've got this big white elephant that they can't use for anything else, but there are some problems with dealing with. So obviously there's still some things left for the folks in Rantoul, but by and large, they seem to have done pretty well.
Right. We do have, unfortunately, a huge national legacy of environmental problems that are the result of weapons production and weapons testing during the Cold War, and since then, there are even areas that one Defense Department writer has called national sacrifice zones, by which he means areas that are so polluted that we have to call them just the price of winning the Cold War. And I think that's a fairly tragic term. There are many places like that where the cost of cleanup is phenomenal.
Is that a problem there, or is it not so much of a problem?
Well, these are particularly places where they were doing the base closings and trying to turn them over to civilian uses and finding that no one wanted to build a school on top of a toxic waste dump. And places elsewhere, too, former U.S. military bases in the Philippines where there's mercury in the water table, places like Micronesia where there's whole atolls that are still uninhabitable because they were the site of nuclear arms testing.
Mentioned a bit ago that that Fort Bragg now is home to some of the most elite military units, those that operate with high levels of security and secrecy. I'm sure in past it was difficult to know, say, if you were connected to the military or even you were just concerned because they were your neighbors, what those people were doing. You know, maybe it wouldn't have been all that easy, but I think probably now the level of secrecy is even higher. That here you would know that people who were in these units, say, were in Afghanistan, but you wouldn't know what they were doing. You wouldn't know where they were. You wouldn't know when they were coming home. You would know virtually nothing. How does that sit with people there, knowing that the soldiers are there, they're in danger, and that they know almost nothing about what they're up to?
Well, I think over the course of 60 years, many people have come both in Fayetteville and around the country to accept the idea of secrecy as a cost of doing war's business, and I think there's some unfortunate effects of that on our democracy. Things are coded secret that have really nothing to do with national security so much as with protecting saving face or protecting the reputation of people who've made mistakes, both in the civilian and the military sectors of the defense industries and defense institutions. So, but people in town, I think, are very accepting of that. They believe that they shouldn't know certain things. And I think that's a new definition of citizenship that that has emerged over the course of the 20th century. The idea that a good citizen is someone who's naive or is not knowledgeable about what the government is doing. And I find that one of the heavy costs of those long years of war preparation and war, because that secrecy occurs throughout the 20th century, not just during wartime.
So is it the case that people who live in Fayetteville, most people have on, if not a daily basis, then a couple of times a week, they have regular sort of interaction with personnel from the base?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So pretty much it's just all the time you see, so you're there in town, you see soldiers out, you see them in the McDonald's, see them in the mall, see, you know, that it's sort of, there's always this feeling that you're there sharing your space with these folks.
Yeah. You're pumping gas and the person next to you is in camouflage and big heavy black boots and shopping in the mall and carrying their babies in after work. And it's very much the scene of everyday life.
And is there the sense that we are sort of all the same, or is there some real sense that me, Mr. Civilian Guy, is very different, that there's somehow a big gap in some way between me and the person who's there in wearing their camouflage filling up the car at the gas station?
Well, actually, I spend quite a bit of time writing about this in the book, and I think it's really fascinating. The pundits, I think we've heard over the last 10 years, the pundits saying that there's this tremendous gap between the military and the civilian world. And what I've found in Fayetteville is that it's a much more blurred boundary, because there are people who are, for example, in civilian clothes, who are in some ways really part of the military world because they were veterans, or they are people who are civilian employees of the Defense Department, or they are 80% of the sales in their record shop are to soldiers. So in some ways, those people are, the boundary is quite blurred. And conversely, you'll see people who are in military uniform who will be in that uniform for a very short amount of time and go back to civilian life. And so I think the idea that there's a gap is way overblown. There are plenty of stereotypes and assumptions on both sides. That can create some hostility. For example, the assumption that all soldiers think the same, that they're all, and that I think that's one of the more pernicious kind of assumptions. And for example, there are soldiers, I've talked to soldiers who were libertarians, and there are plenty of people in the service who think we should be a purely defensive force, we shouldn't be out there mucking around in the world. There are people who are in the military because they want the college benefits, and that's still the number one reason people give for joining the military, is to get college benefits. And so those people are not going to make not there because it's a calling. It's they're there doing a job for a very short period of time and may be anti-authoritarian even. And then there's people who really believe that violence is the way to get things done in the world. People who are ardent nationalists, and there's some people who are, talked to one soldier who told me he'd been all over the world in various conflicts, and he said, "I'm an internationalist." He said, "I could live anywhere." He said, "I love the USA, but I'm an internationalist. I'm a world citizen."
Hmm.
So incredible diversity of view within the military. But civilians sometimes resent a kind of super citizenship that they see soldiers getting and the extra benefits they see them getting. Discounts in stores, for example. And the military people sometimes retort in return, join the military, you can have the same benefits. But in a sense, it really is the kinds of social welfare benefits that the military gets are ones which many people feel should be something that all Americans have, as, for example, many European countries give all of their citizens. Universal health care and so on. So it's a very interesting politics, the relationship between the military and the civilian world.
Yeah. Well, I think we're about at the point where we'll close out, and I want to say thanks very much. We appreciate you giving us some of your time this morning and talking about Homefront.
Great. Well, thanks so much for the chance to talk about it.